last case in our calendar is 96-1447, Angelo Burgos versus Arway Inc. Mr. Schloss.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is John B. Schloss, and I represent Commander Tom Angelo Burgos. I'd probably reserve 3 minutes for a follow-up, I may.
Watch your time.
This case arises from improper grant of summary judgment in favor of Arway Inc. and the affirmance sustained by the 8th District Court of Appeals. In this employer intentional court case, Mr. Burgos suffered serious personal injuries as a new, poorly trained apprentice plager at Arway when he fell backwards into a tank filled with clean solution heated to 190 degrees Fahrenheit. At such time, he was trying to retrieve a rat that had fallen into the tank, and in the process, was using a rake to pull out the rat. And the weight from which caused him to lose his balance and fall backwards into this tank. Sure, considering whether or not there was a genuine issue of material fact under the criteria set forth in the fight, I don't think there's any dispute in any courts below or by opposing counsel regarding the first prong that, in fact, the rack retrieval procedure was a dangerous one. In fact, there's deposition testimony from the plant manager that such process and procedure was dangerous. The issue in this case regarding the second and third prong regarding what Harway's knowledge of substantial certainty that injury would occur based on this process. In these types of cases, no employer is going to, there's rarely, if ever, a smoking gun where an employer says, yes, we had the requisite intent, we had knowledge this injury was going to occur in the workplace. Instead, it's a matter of inferring intent from the particular facts and circumstances in each case. And in this particular case,
it's really a matter, the toughest part is distinguishing intent from gross recklessness, probably. This, you know, that's, it's so bad, but you're going to have to find intent versus recklessness.
That's right, Your Honor. In this case, the suit will govern and regulate egregious conduct in the workplace, and it is beyond negligence and specifically recklessness. And based on the configuration of facts here, I believe that there are at least a genuine issue of material fact regarding the issue of knowledge of substantial certainty of injury. You examine, you take into account that Mr. Burgos has been 4 months, he's very inexperienced, and the company made a conscious decision to give his co-worker, Quint Blankenship, full authority to train him in the rack retrieval process. These racket falls into the hot tanks invariably about 3 times a week. Mr. Blankenship, his trainer and co-worker, never told him about the equipment, the safety of where it should be used for this particular task. Blankenship himself retrieved the boards in a manner without the safety boards, went up on a very narrow space between the tanks, about 9 inches, on a slippery surface. You take into account that this was a regular, this process was a part of the regular business there, that somebody's on a very narrow space, slippery one, tanks of hot chemicals in them at elevated temperatures.
He was not required to do that work, was he? To do what he did. In fact, he had used the boards previously, according to Blankenship, to retrieve racks. He knew how to use the boards. Right, is that correct or not?
I believe it's not correct. I think there's conflicting testimony on that issue. Mr. Burgos mentioned that never was he did he use safety boards for rack retrieval. Safety boards were used in our way for putting certain product in the racks. And that was a separate test.
Okay. The nickel plating.
Safety boards were not used by himself in his testimony, nor that of his co-worker, Quint Blankenship.
Well, as you know, one of the tests under Fife is that the employee is required to perform the work by the employer. The employee is required to perform the work by the employer that causes the injury. Here, he Hoel, is it Hoel, H-O-E-L, he went to get, or Blankenship went to get the supervisor, and it was then that Burgos took it on himself to do, he wasn't really required to do this.
I believe that Mr. Blankenship went to get Mr. Hoel at the time, because not only had the racks fallen, but also the contact bar had fallen. The contact bar weighed about 200 pounds, and required two people to get it out of the tank. So Blankenship and Mr. Hoel indeed took the contact bar out of the tank. After that was accomplished, Hoel went off to tell the people down the line that there would be delay in the production process. At that time, Mr. Burgos then, on his own, got the rack out. To address your question about whether it was, I believe it was Department of Carpenter his job. He understood it to be that. I believe Mr. Blankenship understood it to be both their job to retrieve racks. Now, was it their job to do it in this manner? I think there's conflicting testimony. Mr. Burgos testified that it was his job to take out and get the racks out, and his only training was in this particular method.
But he didn't testify that the employer had ordered him or required him to take the racks out by walking out in the lift, did he? There's no evidence of that.
No specific order, but by way of, in view of the fact that all of his training was done, was provided by his co-worker was taking the racks out of the tank in this manner, he believed that it was part and parcel of the job, and that was the employer expected that. To not only retrieve the racks, but do so in that way.
But now what you're doing is continuing to argue the merits of the case when that's not what's before us at all. This is simply a summary judgment. Was there enough conflicting evidence? And that's what the problem with Fife has been for a long time. We changed Van Fossen some in Fife. I can tell you that the way Fife was originally written, it changed it a whole lot more. The fact is that we're here on summary judgment, aren't we? And whether or not there's any question of fact, material fact, that can be disputed. And the very questions indicate the kind of facts that are in dispute. But my concern with it is the real issue, one of the reasons I voted to take it in, was because of this creeping concept that we have that you must have a multitude of injuries or a half a dozen or something. I mean, when does it come? Do you have to cut off five hands before there's an intentional tort? Or is two enough? And that's what's underlying in this case, I think, that there weren't repetitive injuries. Nobody else fell on the bat before, so therefore it can't be a tort.
Your Honor, I agree. I'd like to reaffirm the holding in Cook versus CDI, where the holding was that lack of prior access is not dispositive on the determination of the second prong of Fife of an employer's knowledge of substantial certainty. And I think one of the problems in the rulings below is that perhaps the courts confuse weight with sufficiency. The lack of prior access goes to weight, not to sufficiency. It's only one factor of many in consideration of that second prong. And again, the judge Nuch has a well-reasoned opinion in Cook. He set forth again that there shouldn't be a rule where each employer is entitled to one serious injury before they're on the hook.
Is it relevant at all? 20 years, never, no other person fell in a bat. Is it? The holding is that it's not dispositive. Is it relevant?
Yes, it's relevant. I submit that again. Echoing Justice's comments, that this was disposed of summary judgment, and I think a jury should decide that this is a question.
Let me ask you, I'm trying to see what the standard is that you would have us apply here. If the employer here had a formal training program, had a supervisor, I guess Hoel or some supervisor, show Burgos how to retrieve the racks with the boards, and instructed Burgos to not step on the lift, that could cause injury, obviously, and that he was to use the boards. Would that satisfy your view of the employer meeting the Fife standard?
I think that would certainly, I don't think the accident would have taken place had he been given adequate training. This is case of egregious training. There's a person who's coming there for all intents and purposes, she's safety board don't exist for this task which is required to perform.
How much, I guess the other question, is how much, how much sort of knowledge do we give credit to an employee for in the workplace for his or her own protection where the employer has not created some, force the employee to do something that is dangerous? Does the employee bear any responsibility at all? Or here the employee certainly must have known that this liquid was harmful, and yet he risked getting on the lift. Is that, do we account, is that irrelevant or is it relevant?
Well, I think it's a jury question and determination, but this is not a negligence case, it's a tort case. We're looking at the employer's conduct. The voluntary assumption of risk is not defense in products cases, nor should it be here. I think you have to examine whether the employee followed directions, whether he followed, whether his behavior comported with the training we see. So in that sense, it could be relevant. I think a finder of fact would bring up record data on that front. So it has some relevance, but not to the point that it's dispositive. So I'd also mention that John DeNega, expert plaintiff, expert in this case, he rendered an opinion that all the elements of fire tests were met, and that I think the lower courts didn't give his opinion much credence, and I think that couple of factors I've set forth thus far, that this case should be returned for jury determination. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schloss. And Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mark Phillips for Appellee, ROA, being joined today by Mr. John Capitreas, also for the Appellee. May it please the court. There is a dispute as to the first element of the fight. There is a dispute as to the application of all of the elements of the fight. All three elements are in fact in dispute. The first element of fight requires the knowledge by the employer of the existence of a dangerous procedure. Here, there's a complete absence of evidence on the record that ROA had knew that Mr. Burgos, or for that matter, any other employee, had sought previously to remove fallen racks by getting on a ledge between two adjoining tanks. There's no evidence of that ROA knew, that any of the supervisory personnel knew, that ROA in general knew that employees were doing this. There's no evidence that they knew that Mr. Blankenship was doing this. And by the way, I would add that Mr. Blankenship's testimony, in his testimony, he does dispute Mr. Burgos's testimony on that point.
Well, is that a critical part of the test?
Excuse me.
The knowledge.
The knowledge by the employer of the existence of the dangerous procedure?
That employees would do on this occasion.
There's no evidence that ROA even knew that employees were doing it occasionally. Mr. Parnell, the supervisor on the day shift, testified that to his mind it was inconceivable that anybody would be doing this. He had never seen anybody attempting to retrieve racks.
Well, it's been alleged that that they were not trained to use boards when they were retrieving racks. You're saying that ROA did in fact provide training for the use of boards at that time?
Mr. Blankenship testified that that's exactly how he was trained, and that's the procedure that he used, that occasionally he did get up on the ledge to retreat Riggs, but that he, there's no evidence that he ever did that in the presence of the supervisor or that Arway ever knew about it. There's no testimony that Blankenship had ever seen Mr. Burgos.
Let's turn it around in terms of the prongs as Justice Douglas. The issue really is, should this go out on summary? You've got this manufacturing procedure with policies of tanks. I take it it's not disputed that things fall in and have to be retrieved.
Correct.
As Justice Resnick asked, is the evidence uncontroverted that people were proper that have to do that? The company knows that this happens and that somebody has to retreat.
Yes.
Okay, that you can see. Now, is the evidence uncontroverted that everybody that should be in a position to have to retreat was properly trained in the proper way to be retreated safely?
I don't believe that the evidence is uncontroverted that everyone was trained in this manner.
Right.
Okay, so the manner that the company provided for, which was first to retreat from the catwalk, if that was not possible to retreat from the...
So the issue of training, there is controversy.
Yes. Does that preclude summary judgment? No, it does not. Here's the undisputed material facts. Mr. Burgos was never told by a supervisor at Arway to use the method for retrieving the fallen ranks that he used on the day of the accident. He wasn't even told to retrieve the racks on the day of the accident. In fact, the testimony is that Mr. Blankenship wasn't even told to retrieve the racks on the day of the accident. The day after the contact bar had been removed, the supervisor left the scene. Mr. Burgos had spontaneously...
How long would this guy be working at this company if stuff falls into the vats and he and everybody else goes and stops the line and leans on the wall?
But the testimony is that in fact what he was expected to do was to attempt to retrieve the racks from the catwalk. And if that didn't work, to have the supervisor assist through the safety planks.
And it's uncontroverted that he was trained in that fashion?
No, it is not uncontroverted that he was trained in that fashion. But it is uncontroverted that he wasn't told to retrieve the racks on that day, and that in fact Mr. Blankenship said, "I'll retrieve the racks." Mr. Burgos had already jumped up on the ledge. That this was a spontaneous action on his part. It's also uncontroverted that there were alternative means available for retrieving racks. For example, from the catwalk. That's exactly how the racks that fell on the day of the accident were retrieved following the accident. Just from the catwalk. There was no necessity for Mr. Burgos to be up on the ledge between the two tanks. In 12 years of plating operations at Arway, there had never been an accident.
Okay, of this sort. Does that...
There you are.
For 12 years. Does that mean summary judgment is it given?
Does it mean that it's a given?
Yeah.
No. What provides that is given why summary judgment was appropriate here is because then in response to those undisputed facts, Mr. Burgos failed to present any evidence which would substantiate that there was no evidence that Arway knew Mr. Burgos or any other employee was retrieving racks from the tank ledge. There was no evidence that Arway mandated that Mr. Burgos retrieved the racks in this way. And there's no evidence, and this is where, in particular, the absence of prior accidents plays a role, a very large role, is in terms of there's no evidence of knowledge that the harm would occur to a substantial certainty. But the importance of the absence of prior accidents lies in the fact that, that to show substantial certainty, that you, the procedure, the method for, the method of retrieving these rats, according to Mr. Burgos, was performed on a weekly, even a twice weekly basis. That's the inference that Mr. Burgos wants you to apply.
Everybody's able to do it without following the thing.
That's right. It had never happened. It is incompatible. That inference is incompatible with the fact that, in fact, in 12 years, nobody had ever fallen in the tank. And that, therefore, you can't find substantial knowledge for substantial certainty. What Mr. Burgos and Mr. Dengo's opinion would appear to want this court to apply is the notion that substantial certainty means that if you do the procedure often enough, eventually harm is going to result. That is not what substantial certainty is about. Substantial certainty is that virtually every time that you perform the procedure or that the act performed, the harm is going to result.
Was there any evidence to show how often these things fell into the vat?
The testimony from Mr. Burgos was approximately twice a week.
Maybe the problem isn't in the vat, it's the problem is with the equipment used to tip things into the vat. If they fall off twice a week, that means someone is it has to be put in a dangerous position to get it out of the vat. And the company knows that they fall off at least twice a week, right?
No.
So shouldn't the company didn't know that?
No. Well, there's another disputed fact. Mr. Burgos' testimony is that they fell off twice a week. His brother's
testimony. You said there's another disputed fact?
That is a disputed fact as to how many times they fell off.
There are some disputed facts, aren't there?
There absolutely are.
They're all over the place.
There are disputed facts from Mr. Burgos' standpoint, but there are undisputed material facts here as to Farway's knowledge, and that's the test under Fife.
Well, isn't let me interrupt. Isn't your strongest argument that that the third prong of the Fife test is that the employer, knowing of the danger, acts to require the employee to continue performing the dangerous task? There's absolutely no evidence in this record, is there? Maybe there is.
No,
the employer here required Burgos to do what he did. There's absolutely no evidence of that, is there? That's to me, that's the basis of the intentional tort. I mean, he's already got his workers' compensation benefits, and now we're looking to see whether the employer intentionally caused him, and our definition of intention, of course, is not mens rea, but acting with this almost mens rea intention, but that the employer requires the employee to engage in a dangerous act, knowing that the act is dangerous. Here, there's absolutely no evidence that the employer required the employee to do that. In fact, the evidence is that it didn't. Isn't that your strongest argument?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. The evidence shows there is no evidence that Farway acted in any manner to require, and to mandate or compel Mr. Burgos to undertake this procedure.
Don't we have to rewrite Fife, that prong of Fife, to have it cover this situation where an employee, take aside, I mean, let's assume that the training wasn't adequate, and that he, some odd reason, doesn't know he shouldn't get up on this ledge, he might fall into this vat where he could seriously burn. Let's take away that. And I have a difficult time with that too, but this is intentional tort, the employer has all the burden. So, but even given that, the employer here didn't require him to do a thing that caused him to engage in the conduct in which he engaged. In fact, Blankenship told him, don't go up there, I'll get it. And he jumped up himself. I guess that's, I'm making your argument for you, but it seems to me to get to the point, that's the most important point. I want to make sure I'm not missing something. Is there anything in the record that suggests that the employer here required him or even suggested that he retrieve the racks in this way?
No, there's nothing in the record. What what Mr. Burgos's argument is, to make his argument, is that he thought that this was something that he was supposed to do as part of his job duties because he had seen others do it.
And isn't that just exactly the problem with Fife and the reason we continue to see so many of these cases under the Fife statute? Before we did Fife, we had them leveling off. Now with Fife again, and just discussing the point you're discussing now, and the third prong says, did act to require the employee. Now, does that mean there has to be a specific order? You go up there, stand on the boards or don't stand on the boards, don't fall into the vat and get burned or do fall into the vat. Did act to require is an affirmative action, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. And that really, if an employee knows that this is part of his job duties to get those racks out of there, short of an employer saying you've got to go do that, I mean, temporarily you know that's your job. So the affirmative act of to require the employee is one problem, but that's not even one concerns me the most, why I would vote for this, bring this in. Is it not so in the rest of Fife where it says procedure or condition, and in the process, this is where we talk about it going from negligence to recklessness to whatever the third part is. And it says, he is treated by the law as if he had, in fact, desired to produce the result. That is, the employer is treated by the law as if he had, in fact, desired to produce the result. Isn't that deliberate intent?
It is intent, yes.
It's deliberate intent. I intend for this employee to fall in this vat and be burned.
Absolutely.
And is that the test standard, for, is that substantial certainty? We found that unconstitutional in, long after that. Because the General Assembly sent us over something that says, deliberate intent is divine. No, substantial certainty is defined to be the deliberate intent to cause the death or injury of an employee. Isn't that murder?
No, it is not.
Deliberate intent to cause the death of another isn't murder?
Substantial certainty is derived from Section 8A of the Restatement and from Professor Cross's treatment of the issue of intent. And that's exactly where the standard comes from. And
Prosser never said that deliberate intent is the standard. He never said you had to have the conscious intention. I mean, short of taking a 2x4 and beating an employee over the head or a gun and shooting him, how would you ever have deliberate intent?
I see that my time's up. Can I finish?
Sure.
I'll answer both parts.
You may.
Justice Douglas's question. The intent that is implied from a finding of substantial certainty is an intent to cause the stated physical consequences. In other words, the harm.
Deliberate intent.
There is an intent there. And the law infers based upon a substantial certainty. In other words, if I were to go out after an Ohio State Michigan game out onto High Street and shoot a gun down the street into the crowd, that 99 out of 100 times, we would know that that bullet would hit someone. That's substantial certainty. In fact, we would describe it as a miracle if that bullet never hit anyone. And that is the level of substantial certainty that's required to come to that determination of intent.
You and I don't disagree. Deliberate intent to cause the result is what that standard is. And that's not what Prosser said substantial certainty was. How about a standard of more probable than not?
Well, then we're into negligence. And that's exactly what this court has previously rejected.
Well, and the reason is that the whole premise of workers' compensation is that the employer gives up their right to defenses and the employee gives up their right to file a suit. And so you can't now have the employer liable for negligence and say that's a fair system. That's the whole idea of intentional tort, is that it has to be something very extreme. It has to be that the employer creates conditions. Surely the employer doesn't intend for an employee to be injured, but they create conditions that reflects such a lack of concern or such a high degree of negligence that we, for some reason, call it intentional tort. Unfortunately, to my view, I don't think we should call this intentional tort, because that suggests, just as Justice Douglas is indicating, that the thing we probably have is that it looks like the employer actually intends for the employee to be injured. Well, of course they don't. I mean, 99.9% hopefully don't. Hopefully 100% don't. But they create the condition that the law says you are going to be deemed to have intended the result because you have created the condition. And that's why I asked this question about the third point, is that the employer requires the employee to engage in the dangerous conduct. That's, to me, that's not, I mean, the knowledge of the dangerous situation, sure, that's important. But when the employer requires the employee to engage in that conduct, knowing that there's a high degree of certainty that someone is going to get hurt if they continue to engage in that conduct. And that's why I think this case is not intentional tort, very frankly, because I don't see, after hearing oral argument, I don't see where there is anything. Summary judgment, sure. And we tend to send cases back on summary judgment because we want to make sure all the facts are heard. I don't see any facts here that indicate the employer required this employee, had that degree of negligence, if you will, or lack of care, that they're liable for intentional tort. Co-counsel, get one more chance to respond. And we've taken your time, Mr.
Thank you,
Mr.
The case I was
Phillips.
Thinking about is Brady versus Safety Clinic.
Yeah, Brady.
The Brady
yes.
case.
Yes. If I could just take 30 seconds to conclude and respond. Yes, the third prong does require an affirmative act, and that is because we are talking about an intentional tort here. We are talking about a inferring from an act, the physical manifestation of a desire to cause this harm. That's why an act is required. And accordingly, we would ask the court to affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Mr. Schloss, you've saved 3 minutes of your time.
I think jury questions abound in this case, as we've discussed. And the third prong seems to me that is it the only criteria that there be a verbal directive from the employer to perform a certain act, or there would be the requirement?
It doesn't have to be verbal. It can be a requirement that by a manual. It can be a requirement in the workplace. It doesn't have to be verbal. Of course not. It just has to be that the employer has to somehow require the employee to continue to engage or to engage in the dangerous act that causes the injury. Where here did the employer require Mr. Burgos to get up on this ledge to retrieve the rack? Is there any evidence that the employer required that? Remember, it's intentional tort. The employer is so negligent, so egregious conduct, that it intends that he fall in the vat and be injured. Where is the employer's requirement here that Mr. Burgos do what he did?
The employer imbued Clint Blankenship with the exclusive duty to train Burgos with the rack retrieval procedure. And that was part and parcel of their jobs. And since, as Justice Sweeney mentioned, these racks, I think the testimony is 2 to 3 times a week would fall in. Burgos had taken the racks out in 4 months and on in the same method and procedure. The company, by way of viewing Blankenship with that authority, is essentially requiring as players that those racks had to be removed, is essentially requiring the job to be done in that manner.
Even the company had boards there that he had used on a vat with dangerous liquid, fluid in it. He had used the boards. He knew how to use them. Apparently had seen employees do it both ways, other employees do it both ways. Surely he must have known that those boards, that the employer provided those boards for safety. Do we not infer that, or do we infer they were?
I think it's a jury question. I've never reported the safety boards based on Burgos' purview used for this specific task.
That's what I thought, that was uncontroverted, that the safety boards were not used to, that there was no training specifically for the use of retrieving rats with safety boards.
But shouldn't we at least require an employee to refuse to use a process in the workplace if he feels this is too dangerous and he should not do it? Then if he's required, if the performance is, listen, it's not dangerous, you go out and do it that way, but shouldn't we at least have an employee have a requirement to say, listen, I think this is dangerous, I'm not going to do it, and unless I'm ordered to do it, I'm not going to. Shouldn't there be some indicia of danger on part of the employee to at least put the employer on notice that, listen, I consider this dangerous, I'm not going to do it, and then the employer then orders them to do it? Wouldn't the employee be in much better position at that point?
Tough world out there. Employees challenging employers about the nature of the job. I think Caribbean's case set forth, employees are dependent on their income, and their employer has to do something or is required to part from their job. They're going to do it.
So you feel that the threat of being fired is sufficient to preclude the employee from voicing any trepidation on his part?
I think that's a reality in the workplace. Yes, it's fear of being fired. In certain cases, employees can do that, should be commended, but as a matter of law, I don't think it should be held against them.
Here he went against the advice of the senior employee. His Blankenship said, I'll do it. And Burgos jumped up and did it. I mean, that's just the opposite of being required to do it. The other employee said, I'll do it. Isn't that right, or am I wrong? Tell me if I'm wrong.
There's testimony. You can construe inferring, and summary judgment, you infer in favor of the non-moving party. I don't think that he said, don't do it. He said he was offering his help. It's true that the co-worker is offering his help, not that not a mandate that you shouldn't do it. And the point was, even if Virgo said, okay, go ahead, Blankenship was going to do it the same way without the safety boards.
Well, but that's Blankenship. That isn't Virgo's, obviously.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please appear in court.
All rise.